The reason I didn't become a professional photographer, I think, is because I'm not a very patient person. Even though I love perfection, I mean, as a person, I'm very imperfect in the sense of my working method. So I tend to take a lot of photographs, probably of the same thing, and then afterwards choose. And I don't get hung up about waiting for the moment, because I don't want to interrupt seeing or being in the moment.
British architectural designer John Pawson is the master of minimalism, but his new photography book shows there's a more colourful side to his repertoire. Pawson tells us why he sees cause for more architects and designers to get behind the lens, today on Section D. This is Section D, Monocle's weekly design show, and I'm your host, Josh Fennett. Also today...
It's amazing to think of 10 years ago, you know, when books were starting to be moved out of new public library projects and put into sort of repositories or archives, less visible, let's put it that way. Gradually, every public library that's been built since has also been gradually removing books. Now we've subverted the entire process and we're just putting images of books on walls.
We consider the role of libraries, the traditional and bookful sort, in the digital age, and ask why one such structure in China is printing images of books rather than stocking the real thing, and of course, if that's a good thing. Plus...
Today, my inbox is bombarded with press releases about new purpose-built design districts in places from London to Dubai. Buzzwords such as cluster and architect design are thrown into the mix in the pitching of creative utopias in up-and-coming neighbourhoods.
We head to Brisbane by way of Amman in Jordan as Monocle's design editor Nolan Giles contemplates the merits and pitfalls of purpose-built spaces, streets and districts for designers. All that coming up right here on Section D on Monocle 24. First up on the show, we sit down with architectural designer John Pawson. Starting with a series of clean-lined and shockingly stark apartment projects in London in the early 80s, Pawson's career has been defined by the minimalist bent and clean lines of his lauded buildings, as well as his sparing use of colour. His oeuvre shifts from houses in Montauk to the Côte d'Azur to shops and restaurants, churches and tableware, and even London's recently opened design museum itself. But it may be a surprise to some devotees that colour, in all its most bright and winsome hues, has been a constant source of inspiration for Pawson. Spectrum is a new book published by Fiden that charts the designer's inspirations through incidental photographs taken on his travels. From sandy, stony cave floors in Israel to soaring temples in Myanmar and TV aerials aloft in the cloudy skies of West London. The collection is colourful, odd, intimate, textured and charming. And I sat down with John to find out just a little more.
My day job is architecture. Because I don't sketch very well, I mean, my sketches in the office are highly prized because they're so naive that they're sort of like cartoons, so people snitch them. But because I don't draw very well, I tend to take photographs of things to remind myself and things that just catch my eye. And I've done that over my whole life, actually. And it's only recently that, I suppose, with the digital age and you can store things now, and I never delete them, so I've got something like 500,000 digital photographs. And I tend to use them to try and explain to people what I want in the office. And then I'm very lucky that someone else will then draw up what I was thinking.
Well, I was going to ask you, your schedules are obviously extremely busy, from residential projects to the design museum last year. I was going to ask you how you had time to pursue this hobby alongside your work, but it sounds to me like you might think that this is part of your work. Would that be a fair way of looking at it?
Well, it's a relaxing thing, but it is just part of my life. I've gotten so used to taking the photographs that I hope it doesn't come between me and the event or the moment. I mean, I always worried for a bit that if you concentrating on looking through the camera, you miss what's really there. But I sort of always worry that, you know, that what I've seen is the last time I'm ever going to see it, which is probably true. I don't mean that in a macabre way or a morbid way, but, you know, you'll never quite see something in that light. And I'm so, it's sort of like a cliche in a way, but, you know, happy to be alive. I mean, when you wake up and you look out, and it's always different, you know, even in West London. I mean, it's either misty or, humid or overcast or, you know, interesting bits of sunlight. And I really like capturing the everyday, the very sort of ordinary things which can become extraordinary. It's interesting how the book came about because I, you know, take these photographs for myself, and it was Fiden that said, you know, how about a book? And I said, fine, and I'll take a lot of white photographs for you. And they said, no. I think, you know, we'd like a book going through the whole spectrum, the whole colour spectrum, which, of course, I thought, oh, my gosh, you know. So I handed over my archive to Max and Nick in the office, and they started to put this together with the editor of Fiden.
Your famous work is, you know, but kind of prided on the minimalism, the removal of the unnecessary and the superfluous. I wonder if, you know, beneath those beautiful cabinets in those stark kitchens, there are actually boxes of photographs. How did you preserve a lot of them from the older era?
Because I have an office. I mean, the office is very much a workshop. It's full of stuff. I mean, it drives me slightly crazy. I mean, but there are boxes of photographs and boxes of negatives. And it's been the same approach. I've never, with work and with photography and drawings and these sort of things, I've actually never thrown anything away. And, you know, I can find them. But I think one day, obviously, there'll come a time when someone, or if not me, has to go through the archive and ditch the stuff.
When I look at the beautiful photos within the book, of which there are more than 300 that you chose, you know, you focus on sometimes rather diffuse things. It could be the shadow at the bottom of a Doric column or the hairs on the back of a horse's neck. You draw inspiration from a lot of different places. I wonder, do you take many photos of the same thing, or do you just take one to capture it and you believe that to be the thing that you want, or do you kind of strain over it sometimes?
I mean, the reason I didn't become a professional photographer, I think, is because I'm not a very patient person, even though I love perfection. I mean, as a person, I'm very imperfect in the sense of my working method. So I tend to take a lot of photographs, probably of the same thing, and then afterwards choose. And I don't get hung up about waiting for the moment. I just keep, you know, because I don't want to interrupt seeing or being in the moment.
Did you ever worry about, not sullying your reputation for a clean white line, but, you know, adding an extra note to the symphony of your work and how it might be perceived, or was that maybe the intention?
I think they're two very different things. I think one is the things that capture my eye and my imagination, and I don't want to lose that memory, or I want to be able to share the memory with other people rather than just describe it. But the architecture is a very particular kind of architecture, which, you know, follows sort of methods, whether it be a monastery or a spoon. You know, you have these tenets which you kind of follow. Colour comes from natural things in the work, be it stone or wood or the steel of a window frame, but it tends to be quite muted colours because, you know, I'm very, very keen on space and making space, and it feels freer to me if your eye is not arrested by a strong colour. And then the materials I use don't have strong colours, and I don't particularly, you know, fresh-cut flowers from the garden is fine because they don't last very long. And I'm happier without paintings on the wall, not because of the colour, but more that it stops your eye. There isn't really the room, you know, and I don't miss, you know, because the colour is very subtle in my work, in the architecture. It comes from the changing light and things like that.
But obviously you've taken these photos as you've travelled round. Can you tell me about, I suppose, the relative importance of the image, but also of taking the image and of going and kind of bearing witness to the things that give you the inspiration? Because I suppose I'm making the contention that younger designers who might be desk-based and have all of the images in the world on their computer, actually there's something a bit different to, you know, to bearing witness and to being present. Do you think that's true?
You tend in architecture not to get given jobs until you getting on a bit. I mean, in my case, 50 or 60. The real work is just coming in now. Obviously, you have a whole range of visual and personal experiences which go to make up a much richer mental back catalogue. So you're drawing on, you know, before you put pen to paper, really, or you have this sort of richness there. I don't think you're ever going to get inspiration from books or things. I mean, of course, you have to study when you're at school and you have to study other people's work, but I think there's nothing like going out and experiencing it. And when you're actually designing in the studio or in wherever you are designing, because you're designing all day wherever you are, I think when you're designing, the ideas come from applying yourself to a set of problems or challenges. So you don't say, okay, I'm going to design a monastery and then get out lots of books about monasteries or religious things. You know, you work through it.
For any obsessive shutterbugs listening, what kind of kit do you use, and what kind of kit do you prefer for producing these kind of doubtlessly beautiful images?
Of course, it's not about the kit. I was very, very happy with my Canon, which then became a Sony, which then, of course, has become an iPhone. I think one of the reasons I like the iPhone is that, I mean, obviously people know you're taking a photograph, but, I mean, it's not in the face. I mean, I've always used very small cameras and tried not to, and I don't usually take people or start using it in sensitive places.
And as a very final question, I've opened the book on a random spread, and I can see a kind of uplit portico in Jaffa in Israel, taken in June 2013. I can see the sort of frayed ends of a curtain with the little bit of light trickling underneath from Myanmar. Are there any images that you took that kind of really meant something to you and still means something to you that might be emblematic of your approach, maybe when everyone was looking one way and you were perhaps looking another?
I'm always interested in how, when you're confronted with something to look at, even if everyone is a similar height and has the same colour readings, that they see and they take very, very different photographs. The slight subtleties are extraordinary. And you think, well, were they there or was I there? Myanmar is obviously a very rich thing because it's so different from what you're used to. But then that sometimes makes it more difficult because in a way the mundane and the ordinary are what appeal to me.
And so should aspiring architectural designers, should they be out with their cameras and looking for inspiration in all of these kind of diffuse places as well, would you say?
I don't think it's about going out to get inspiration. I think it's about seeing what's in front of you. You know, I remember Bruce Chatwin saying that the most interesting country he'd ever been to was Germany, because it's obviously because of the psyche. The truly exotic to a Western European isn't necessarily, Central Africa. It's right here on your doorstep.
British architectural designer extraordinaire John Pawson there, talking to me about his new photography book Spectrum, published by Fiden and available at all self-respecting bookstores now. Now an aside about an architect across the pond. Canadian-born Frank Gehry's audacious work enrages and enraptures in equal measure. Think of Bill Bowers bursting from the Earth Guggenheim Museum or the swirling steely turns of the Walt Disney Concert Hall, home to the Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra. Now Gehry has been charged with providing a permanent home for the LA Youth Orchestra too, at a space in Inglewood that's hoped will help it double in size over the next 5 years. Concert halls and opera houses, though often marred by delays, budget fudges and harumphing locals, can be, puns excused, a sound investment for cities. From Sydney's long-maligned, now-lauded Jørn Utzon-designed opera house to Herzog & de Meuron's 2017 Hamburg Concert Hall, they are an opportunity for architects to create bold symphonies of form that can define a city. Next, we turn the page to talk tomes and to New York, where a Dutch practice named Meccano revealed its master plan for the redesign of the city's public library, the main Beaux-Arts building on Fifth Avenue, that is. Set to be completed by 2021, the library selected Meccano for the project in 2015 after abandoning a $300 million proposal from British firm Foster & Partners, under which many of the book stacks would have been shelved to create a larger reading room. The Metaphorical Section D mailbag is, don't forget, always open to queries and suggestions. Do get in touch by emailing our producer, Ben Ryland. He's at br@monocle.com. This is Section D. Do stay tuned. Joining me now for a run-through of the must-know stories in the world of architecture this week is show friend and architecture critic for the ages. It's, of course, James Taylor Foster. So, James, we've just been hearing a little bit about the developments in the world of physical libraries in the age of the internet. Do we still need them? Tell us a little bit about a project that you've dug up.
Well, this library has been designed by a Dutch practice called MVRDV, and it's called the Tianjin Binhai Library. It's in China, and it's enormous, as most things are. You raise a very important discussion about the role of libraries, you know, because everything you said is totally correct. But of course, they're very important, especially in countries which are sort of accelerating rapidly and sort of presenting public projects and presenting a vision of knowledge building. This library was when images were released, almost went viral, because it's this kind of enormous space with shelves kind of undulating around the walls and a vast kind of spherical volume in the middle. And the reality is that most of the shelves are inaccessible, and those shelves which are inaccessible have printed pictures of books on them.
Wow, that's the equivalent of going into someone's house and thinking they've got a nice library and realising it's wallpaper, isn't it?
Absolutely. Or like those images of fake bricks on walls that people put in their living rooms. So it's basically, to me, it feels like deception. Architectural deception. Now, of course, we haven't heard from MVRDV in terms of, I'm sure they'll attempt to post-rationalise it in some way, as architects tend to do. But the reality is that this statement is kind of paradoxical in so much as it's saying, yeah, books are important as a kind of visual statement about a knowledge-centered state, or a state which aspires to knowledge. But in reality, it's not practical. And, you know, public libraries today are about gathering, they're about meeting, they're about providing places for people to take their laptop out and work. You know, enough plug sockets is important, strong Wi-Fi is important. You look at most of the new libraries being built around the world. The one which comes to mind is the new public library in Helsinki, which is being designed by ALA Architects. Very intelligent design. I mean, it's an architectural statement in itself, but there are almost no books in it, right? I mean, it's essentially just a kind of space for meeting. That's what a contemporary library should be. Most approaches to contemporary libraries, books are going into archives and you can collect them if you need to.
And we're seeing an increasing specialization, I suppose, is kind of what you're describing there, in the service that the library offers. It's not a repository of every book you'll go to. Lord knows, some of those books are pictures of books. But if you think about the Choi Wook-designed Hyundai Card Cooking Library in Seoul. Mm. That's an architectural statement. It's a collection of cooking books. It's lovely in pictures. Are we in danger of overlooking the merits of an actual library while we cater to people's flexible work environments, do you think?
You know, possibly. I think that there's something to be said. I mean, the ultimate reality is, with these projects, is they kind of build upon the one that's come before. So it's amazing to think of 10 years ago, you know, when books were starting to be moved out of new public library projects and put into sort of repositories or archives, less visible, let's put it that way. Gradually, every public library that's been built since has also been gradually removing books. Now we've subverted the entire process and we're just putting images of books on walls. I think that the ultimate goal of a library is about the exchange of knowledge. The decision about whether that involves books or not is clearly down to the individual. I would say it does. But obviously, you know, that's not the prevailing wind at the moment.
And James, your wise eyes have rested on the Chicago Architecture Biennial, which has taken off over the past couple of years. And it's raised a couple of questions for me, which I'd like to put for you. Does every city in the world need an architecture showcase?
Good question. You know, the Chicago Architecture Biennial is interesting because it's new, right? The first one was in 2015. And it was sort of, you know, wow, there's an architecture exhibition in North America. This is a big deal because most of the architecture exhibitions are focused on Europe, and they're now spreading out into Asia as well. So there was a kind of lot of goodwill about it. It was like, wow, it's here. Okay, it's curatorial, a bit questionable, but okay, fine. This is great. The second time around is a big deal because it's already there. And the question is, how good is the show? How good, how well has it been curated? And how interesting are the participants? Now, as far as this one goes, it's a beautiful show. It's a spectacular show in many places. It's all housed in the Chicago Cultural Center, which is this amazing monumental building in the center of downtown. It's unique in the sense that most biennales are spread all around the place. This is sort of centrally located. There are lots of satellite events, but it's coherent and it's logical. The question for me is, obviously, from my perspective, is how well curated is it? I'm not sure whether it's curated at all. It's called Make New History. So the idea is it's bringing together lots of contemporary architects to sort of look back into the past and try and project into the future, you know, while always remaining in the present.
Are you calling cop-out on it?
I'm not calling cop-out on it, but I'm saying there are two ways of doing an exhibition, right? You either curate it or you organise it. This has been organised. It's a lovely assemblage of beautiful objects. But for me, there has to be tension. There has to be friction between what's going on. It has to be politically relevant. And the only thing which makes it politically relevant is that it's sponsored by BP.
Chicago's a city with an incredible history, albeit, you know, be it for the study of urbanism, be it for the beautiful buildings, you know, the birth of the skyscraper and the amazing people that practice there. You know, what are the notes in your mind that it hit moving forward? Do you think the curation of it has given any answers, has sparked any interesting debates? Or my sense is from your reading of it that actually it's been a bit of a talking shop and, you know, it maybe hasn't lived up to expectations. What are your kind of
thoughts?
Well,
first of all, I think the expectations are very high. And of course, there are extremely beautiful moments. There are two sections, one called the horizontal city and one called the vertical city, which are all models and they're kind of monumental installations. The vertical city is based on the Chicago Tribune Tower competition. You talk about Chicago as the birthplace of the skyscraper. Certainly, there have been some very important skyscrapers built there. And this was sort of an homage to that. Very, very interesting, beautiful installations by people like Offis Kirsten van Geers and David van Severen and all the way through to people throughout Europe. The issue is that as you're looking at this, it sort of is beautiful, fairly superficially beautiful. And of course, it has struck a chord with people who aren't necessarily architects. And I think that's an important thing to acknowledge. I think all too often these biennales, triennales, these events in architecture can be speaking to the professional, not to the wider public. I think that the identity of the Chicago Architecture Biennale is probably still kind of collecting itself. It's not quite there. It's sort of spread across maybe too thinly intellectually. But in terms of what it projects into the future, I don't know. I mean, I think it gathers together a beautiful group of architects who make beautiful things. And I think they're quite happy to be together. I'm not quite sure whether that's a good thing or not. I think the idea of movement building in architecture maybe is more dangerous than people suggest.
Interesting. So I love the idea of you questioning who it's for as well, because, you know, a lot of people, when they're thinking about the funding, think this is how many people are going to pass through. This is how many people are going to see it. This is the effect it's going to have. But sometimes hard to judge. One thing that is having an effect in the headlines, and a huge effect, is something that I think has taken longer to build than Monocle magazine, and we had our 10th anniversary at the beginning of the year. I'm talking, of course, about Jean Nouvel's Louvre Abu Dhabi, which opened in early November. Quite a stunning building, quite an odd place, I think people agree. You know, maybe the project stems from the time when a lot of cultural institutions were looking at Dubai and Abu Dhabi, the Emirates, all around the Middle East, as a kind of boom region where culture was going to be paid for by luxury brands, by deep pockets.
Yeah.
And here we are in a slightly different era. What do people think now the doors have finally slid open?
Well, you're right. I mean, it was conceived of 10 years ago and it was 6 years late. I was there the first public day. Right, so it had already had this kind of extremely glitzy opening with Emmanuel Macron and all these kind of, you know, people flying in, and I mean, so many sheikhs that, you know, you start to lose track of
more sheikhs than you can shake a piece of artwork at.
Precisely, you strike a really interesting chord with me there because it feels dated. And that's a strange thing to say about a building which is just open. I mean, the whole point of architecture is that you're trying to design something that you know is going to exist in the future. However, the architectural concept, which, you know, I have an enormous press release here in front of me from the Louvre. You know, it must be said also as a journalist in the Emirates, it can be quite scary at times, especially in terms of when you start asking questions about migrant worker conditions and, you know, living conditions, which obviously we were forbidden to see. But its architect, Jean Nouvel, who's a French architect, talks constantly about this dome and talks constantly about light and shade. So, yes, there is a dome. It's a 180-meter diameter dome. It's spectacular. I've never seen anything quite like it before. The dome is obviously a very significant kind of typology, building typology, Arabian building typology. It's hot there. You need to have shade. it's a very good idea to play with light because there's a lot of light. And you look at it and it's amazing. And it was beautiful moments where I was stood in this kind of central plaza, which should have been a public space, by the way, but it's completely broken off from any kind of public promenade. And there were people walking around gasping, you know, and a beautiful mix of people from lots of French people speaking there, obviously the first day, lots of local people, families there. It was incredible to see how this building is uniting essentially a nation, really. But at the same time, you look beneath the dome, and I'm speaking specifically architecturally here, the concept was of a medina of galleries. So it's a rather chaotic assemblage of volumes. And, you know, weaving your way through these galleries, you do sort of lose sense of where you are at times. Occasionally you get glimpses to the sea. Occasionally you get glimpses to courtyards. It's enormous. And unfortunately, in spite of the fact it's 6 years late, my overarching feeling is that the dome, perfectly engineered, spectacular, but I'm looking at it from a distance. The buildings themselves, they are really almost shoddily finished. And I think, confusion is an architectural motif, which some people try and strive for. I don't think Jean Nouvel was striving for that. I was just unsatisfied by the experience of going through the galleries, irrespective of the work, by the way. We're going from Picasso to Mondrian to Cezanne to Pollock to Kandinsky. It's just spectacular.
And our special thanks to design writer, man about town, gentleman and scholar James Taylor Foster there. Finally on the show, we've been thinking about the curious prevalence of so-called design districts, popping up as they are from Dubai to Detroit. But how important are purpose-built creative corners? And might a city's design community be more fruitful if it were left to evolve naturally, or if designers were given room to roam? Monocle's design editor Nolan Giles gives us his take.
I always loved visiting the office of celebrated graphic designer Kevin Finn in Brisbane. Set high up in a corporate central business district building, the space has gorgeous views of the city. Finn's space is quiet and calming, thanks in part to a soundtrack of Aphex Twin and Brian Eno, but also because it is isolated from the bustle of any other creative practices. Brisbane didn't really have co-working spaces or designer-filled neighbourhoods when he established his practice here in 2010, but since then, such areas have become abundant. Finn, however, remains steadfast in his location, telling me he'd get caught up in too much conversation if he was to be in a collective space. Today, my inbox is bombarded with press releases about new purpose-built design districts in places from London to Dubai. Buzzwords such as cluster and architect design are thrown into the mix in the pitching of creative utopias in up-and-coming neighbourhoods. I wonder, actually, how conducive they are to the creative fabric of a city. It feels more like a developer adding value to a residential site in an unloved part of town to give it some cool cachet. Yet, on my visit to Amman to report on the city's burgeoning design scene, I felt the effect of what happens when no such creative corners exist. The design was strong and the energy optimistic, but the community felt disjointed. There was a yearning among its many young creatives to feel closer to their contemporaries. Designers don't need to sit in ivory towers to do good work, but nor do they need to be in purpose-built pens. The best cities for design are the ones that are left to evolve naturally. I'm sure Amman's creative community will find its sweet spot, but I'm also sure this will be without the help of a developer trying to ride off the back of its success. For Monocle, I'm Nolan Giles.
Thanks very much to Nolan for that report. And do remember, you can delve deeper into our design reporting in the pages of Monocle magazine. Coming up on next week's show.
We are people who travel a lot. We are people who enjoy food and wine, and I think that's why we are so close to our product, is because we use it.
As Santa's sleigh careens ever closer, we hone in, like the greedy folk we are, on design at the dining room table. Maximilian Riedel, CEO of Austrian glassware and decanter doyen of the same name, spills the secrets of the perfect wine glass. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. Section D was produced by Ben Ryland and Daphne Karnesis and edited by Sarah Miles. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.